All right, there we go. That makes more sense. All right, memory work. Let's go ahead and do that together. There are 17 books of what first? Law, history, then 5 books of poetry, then 17 books of prophecy. And let's go ahead and say those together. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 1 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. Very good. Question for you. Since we are in this section of Nehemiah, Ezra, Nehemiah talking about the restoration of the people coming back from Babylon, which of those prophets up there are contemporaries with that period of history, the coming back after Babylon? Which prophet's up there? Anybody got one? What's that? So Ezra is a prophet, but in the literary prophets, so in the last 17 books of history, or of the Old Testament, which of those prophets fit in the restoration? What's that? So Daniel is in the Babylonian captivity, as is Ezekiel. But as we're coming back, we read about a couple of them in Ezra. Do you remember? All right, Haggai and Zechariah, and then one more. And this would be the one closest to Nehemiah. Malachi, right. Which makes sense, it being at the end. And I might make reference to that here in a bit, because the things that happen at the end of the book of Nehemiah kind of help us understand why, when God finally speaks with the last prophet of Malachi, why he's saying the things he's saying. So, sorry, that was a curveball, but I thought that'd be a way to wake your brains up this morning. All right, let's say these 12 divisions of history together. If you can do them from memory, that's best. Pre-flood, post-flood, patriarchal, bondage, wanderings, conquest, judges, united kingdom, divided kingdom, Judah alone, captivity, restoration. So those first 17 books from Genesis to Esther, you can think of Israel's history with these 12 divisions. And as you memorize them, I encourage you to fill in names, events, like what's actually happening in each of those categories. And so now we are in the restoration, and we're looking at the books of Ezra through Esther. Let's just go ahead and jump into Nehemiah. Last week, we were looking at the first half. We didn't quite finish, so we're going to get back into that. But let's review the questions, and this will be our review for Nehemiah as well. So at the beginning of Nehemiah, where is Nehemiah? All right, he's in Susa. What's that? Where is that? That's not Israel or the land of Israel, right? Yeah. All right, so it's the capital of Persia. So at the end of the Babylonian captivity, the Persians had taken control. Many of the Jews ended up sort of being a part of that regime and that culture. Nehemiah is one of them. What's his job as he's working for the king of the Persians? He's a cupbearer. Pretty important position. And we have this scene at the beginning where Nehemiah begins to weep pretty greatly. Why is he weeping at the beginning of the book? Just say it if you know it. Go ahead. All right. So Jerusalem was destroyed a long time ago, right? I mean, it's been, you know, even almost a century and a half or more that Jerusalem was destroyed by the Babylonians. And he's hearing reports about what's going on in the city. This is a kind of a backwards way to ask this. What was already rebuilt in Jerusalem that when Nehemiah would have heard reports, one of the reports he would have heard is, hey, this has been rebuilt. What was rebuilt already? The temple was already built. Who built it? Who were the leaders that came back and built that? Zerubbabel and Joshua, remember that? At the beginning of Ezra. And Ezra had made a trip there not long before Nehemiah to kind of reestablish the law and the priesthood and the prophets and the activities within the temple. So that would have been good news, but Nehemiah is weeping specifically because of what? What's that? Yeah, so the walls are down. The walls haven't been rebuilt in all the years they've been back. The morale of the people is not good. And so Nehemiah is very troubled about it. What do you remember us talking about last week or from the beginning of the book? What does Nehemiah kind of do about all of this as he hears about it and weeps? What are some other things he does? All right, he spends time in prayer, not just once. It sounds like he prays every day about this situation. What else? Yeah, very good. So not only does he pray, he plans and prepares. These are all P words, I guess, so you can remember them. Prays, plans, and prepares. And he decides he's going to be the one to go back and stir the people up to do it. If you really think about that, that's kind of a crazy notion, isn't it? He's far away from Israel. He doesn't really have, at the moment, the freedom in his life to do it. He has to ask for permission to do it. It's a long journey. There's a lot that has to be done. Does Nehemiah really even know very many people, you think, in Jerusalem, like personally? Like, these are his people, but he doesn't really know them. They would have been growing up there. He was growing up in a different place. So all of that is pretty fascinating. Anything you want to add to that as we keep going? So when Nehemiah makes his trip over to Jerusalem, this is question number 3 in your booklet. What was the first thing he did when he got there? Yeah, so at nighttime, he goes out and just inspects the walls. Doesn't really tell anybody why he's there, what he's doing, at least as far as we can tell. But under the cover of night, goes out and looks at all the damage that's done in the city. Why do you suppose he does that? Why do you think that's his choice? I think there's wisdom in it, but what would you say about that? Yeah. Okay, yeah. So did you say stir up emotion? Is that what you said? Commotion? Yeah. Yeah, if some guy rolls into town, especially being from Persia, right? Do you think there was a tendency for some Jews to look at other Jews who weren't in Jerusalem as maybe lesser, or they should be here with us, and Nehemiah is not there? He's not going to just roll into town and walk in and say, I'm your leader, you're going to do all this, without taking some time to kind of assess the situation. All right, after he inspects the walls at night, what does he do next? Do you remember there in chapter 2? Yeah, so he calls the leaders together. If you look down there, verse 17. Chapter 2, verse 17. Then I said to them, and that's the leaders that he gathered, you see the bad situation we are in, that Jerusalem is desolate and its gates burned by fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach. I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me, and also about the king's words which he had spoken to me. Then they said, let us arise and build. So they put their hands to the good work. I really like verse 18, by the way. So however long this meeting took with them, he encourages them. He tells them about how great things have been leading up to this moment, the favorable nature of, like, his request and the supplies and all of that. And these people just say, let's get up and work. Let's arise and build. And they just get at it, which I think is really good. Any other comments about that? All right. Who were, this is question number 4 in your booklet, who were the 3 main men who were the enemies of Nehemiah. You can just look right for a couple of them. You look in the next verse, but yeah. All right, Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite, and Geshem or Geshem, however you like to say that, the Arab. And those guys do a number of things to try to hinder the work. We'll talk about that here in a minute. I think we left off with what problems does Nehemiah have to deal with among his own people? Question number five. This is in chapter 5, so let's read a little bit about that. Verse 1. Now there was a great outcry of the people and of their wives against their Jewish brothers, for there were those who said, "We, our sons, and our daughters are many, therefore let us get grain that we may eat and live." There were others who said, "We are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our houses that we might get grain because of the famine." Also, there were those who said, "We have borrowed money for the king's tax on our fields and our vineyards. Now our flesh is like the flesh of our brothers, our children like their children. Yet behold, we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters are forced into bondage already, and we are helpless because of our fields and vineyards belong to others." All right. What did we just read there? How does this describe the nature of the situation there? I suppose it's not a lot unlike many societies, but what did we just read? Okay, some of the people are in debt. Are all of them in debt? Yeah, some of them are doing well. That's kind of how it starts. Like, there are those that they're flourishing. They've got large families. They've got things going well. But then there are others around there that aren't doing so well. They're having to sell their land to sort of deal with all of that. And then there are some people that are just completely overtaxed and overwhelmed and having to sell their children essentially into bondage because of it. Can you imagine how that would make the city of Jerusalem and the people of Israel like not want or not be thinking about trying to rebuild the city? Any other comments about that? All right, what's Nehemiah's reaction to this? All right, why do you think it's anger in the next verse? Verse 6 says, "Then I was very angry, and I had when I had heard the outcry and these words, I consulted with myself and contended with the nobles and the rulers and said to them, 'You are exacting usury each from his brother.' Therefore, I held a great assembly against them." You know, there's a number of different emotions that people can have about this sort of state of some people's lives. I don't know that anger is always one of them. Sometimes we can just be frustrated or shrug our shoulders and say, "Well, that's just the way the world is." But Nehemiah is mad about it and actually begins to sort of try to remedy the situation. How does he go about doing that? What are your thoughts about how Nehemiah handles this? Peter? All right, yeah, he's very clear when he gathers them together and kind of has a council against them and all of that. If you look at verse 9 of chapter 5, "Again I said, 'The thing which you are doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies? And likewise, I, my brothers, and my servants are lending them money and grain. Please let us leave off this usury.'" What's a good definition of usury? What's usury? Yeah, just an interest rate that's hard to deal with, right? Was Nehemiah against lending? He was not against lending or helping with thought of like repayment and all of that, but he was against the idea of making it very difficult for people. Anything else to say about this moment? Yeah. Yeah, very good. It is, I think, telling that in the law of Moses, God was against doing this to your brothers. He did not want people taking advantage of people's difficult financial situations and gaining a bunch of money for themselves on the backs of their brothers. And so he says, you need to fear the Lord and stop this. Yeah.
He got angry. He thought about what approach he should take and then address the nobles.
Yeah, that's a great point. He's angry, but he does take some thought, take a beat, take a moment, figures out how to approach this, and ends up with a pretty good outcome, right? Good. Any other thoughts there? This might remind you a little bit of when Jesus comes into the world later. He ends up in the temple complex, and he sees sort of the usury and the business that's going on there that would have really been a hard thing for the poor. And in his anger, even though he took a beat, he went away that night and made a whip. He handles it a little different than Nehemiah. He goes back to the place and flips the tables over. Good thoughts. Anything else about that? All right, question number 6 in your booklets, I asked, what did the builders do to defend against attack? So it wasn't just that there were internal problems. Most of their problems were coming from the outside, and some of it was actually like force and threat. What did you notice them doing to deal with that? Anybody find a passage for that? All right, look at chapter 4, verse, I'm going to start reading in verse 15, but Christina's bringing up verse 17, we'll get there. 4:15 says, when our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had frustrated their plan, then all of us returned to the wall, each one to his work. From that day on, half of my servants carried on the work, while half of them held the spears, the shields, the bows, and the breastplates. And the captains were behind the whole house of Judah. Those who were rebuilding the wall and those who carried burdens took their load with one hand doing the work and the other holding a weapon. Can you imagine having to work under conditions like that? So you split up your force. Half of them are just sort of standing guard. The other half are working. But even the ones that are doing the kind of work where they're carrying, I don't know if this is hyperbolic or if it's just a way to say half of us were doing one thing or another, but it sounds like to me literally somebody be carrying a load and holding a weapon, which means the enemies were close enough that sometimes you had to, you know, shoo them off or whatever it was. But yet the people still just keep at it. Any thoughts about that? Clay?
I think the point is really kept going, it kept moving forward, and even with our own things that we have challenges for, if we wait until everything is cleared up and nobody has any issues with what we're doing, we'll never get anything done because we'll stop doing what we're supposed to do. And they kept going, they kept doing what God wanted, they kept moving forward even during challenging circumstances. So I just think that's worth it.
Yeah, very good. So I mean, one of the great things that's happening in this book is God's being favorable to the people here, but he's being favorable with them as they persist and keep at it, even when there are things that would cause many people to give up. You guys remember the temple project that Zerubbabel did? How did that group of people do with the building project? They did not do as well as this group. They started well, but they didn't continue, and they had to have like the prophets come and stir them up. But to Clay's point, I think this is great for us to think about these days. God's people keep doing God's work through pandemics, through political difficulties, through whatever some people look at as a threat to the work. It may move a little slower at times. It may be that you have to like do multiple things at once to deal with it. But here is a story of people that just kept at it. And I think that's great. Any other comments? Yeah. They had a what? A rally horn? Is that what you said? Yeah, very good. So I don't remember which verse it is. Maybe somebody finds it. But you're right. There was kind of a plan in place that as we're working, if we see the enemies come and you hear the horn blow, like everybody jump up and we have to fight for a bit and then we'll get back to work. It's hard to imagine what that would have been like, I think. And especially for these people who for many years hadn't been doing anything like this. You know, they just had let this go. Good. Look back at chapter 4, verse 6. I think this is one of my favorite verses in Nehemiah. Chapter 4, verse 6 says this. So we built the wall, and the whole wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. Isn't that a good phrase? I don't know if your version says something different. If I was to ask for a show of hands, how many of you have children that have a mind to work, like as kids? That's not an attitude of immaturity typically. But as people get older, their mindset changes to, hey, I can be productive and I can do things with the time and the energy that I have. But that's what this people was. They had a mind to work, and so they got at it and they did it. All right, any last thoughts there? Yeah.
The priests were building part of the walls. Perfumers were out building part of the wall. It wasn't just the tradesmen, you know, it was everybody. It was all hands on deck.
Yeah, I love that too. When you read through the list of people, it wasn't just like the carpenters and the masonries and all of that. It was, like you said, it was the perfumers and the priests, you know, guys who normally were flipping pages. They didn't flip pages back then, but unrolling scrolls. There was also a description of how a lot of people just focused on the wall that was like near their house. It was kind of like they divvied up the work of, hey, this is your area, do this. And then everybody kind of did that along the way, and it went very quickly. So that, I think there's a lot of great instruction in that. So, yeah.
You don't want to have the wall broken in front of your house. That's the whole.
That's true. That's a good point. If everybody else builds the wall near their house, you're the breach. You know where the enemy's coming, right? So, yeah, that's a good. I hadn't really thought about that. So, you can make your neighbor work harder by getting your wall done faster. So maybe there were some contests. All right, let's keep moving. Question number 7. How was Nehemiah different from the previous governors that these people had been used to? How was he different? Okay, do you have a reference for that?
No.
Okay. Yeah, he behaved himself very differently. He did not act like somebody that needed to be well-fed and well-paid. But also, look here at chapter 5, verse 14. Moreover, from the day that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year to the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes for 12 years, neither I nor my kinsmen have eaten the governor's food allowance. But the former governors who were before me laid burdens on the people and took from them bread and wine besides 40 shekels of silver. Even their servants domineered the people, but I did not do so because of the fear of God. I also applied myself to the work on this wall. We did not buy any land, and all my servants were gathered there for my work. Moreover, there were at my table 150 Jews and officials, besides those who came to us from the nations that were around us. Now that which was prepared for each day was one ox and six choice sheep. Also birds were prepared for me. And once in 10 days all sorts of wine were furnished in abundance. Yet for all this, I did not demand the governor's food allowance, because the servitude was heavy on this people. Remember me, O my God, for good, according to all that I have done for this people. So as Charity said, I mean, one of the things was he wasn't eating the governor's allowance. So in that society, in that time, it was kind of just one of those things where as the people were taxed, if you were in charge, you could take that and use it for your own benefit. But Nehemiah behaves himself very differently. Anybody have any thoughts about that section there? Like what it says about Nehemiah, what it means by way of application? Anybody ever experienced anything like this in real life? If you've ever had a place where you worked where you had like a domineering sort of boss and he thought that the work would get done by, you know, making life really miserable on everybody, but then maybe you had somebody that was far different, more generous, created a different environment for everybody. There's maybe some lessons in that, but any thoughts about it? All right, very good. Yes, he didn't act like he was above them. He was just one of them. He worked with them. Now, sort of add to that, was it obvious that he had more than everybody else in the thing we just read? Yeah, he had a lot more than everybody else. So what did he do with that? He didn't take all the money that he had and buy land for himself. What was he doing? How did he describe it? Look there at verse 17, 18. What was he doing? What? Does that sound like an inexpensive thing to do all the time? 150 people, feeding them after so many days, having even sort of a larger gathering. Like, instead of taking what he had and just using it for himself, he was using his resources to, again, create an environment and encourage other people to participate. So yes, he was just one of them, but he was obviously different in some ways, but didn't use that difference to create a distance. He invited them around. You may have seen that before with some of our, you know, there are people who have space in their homes to have people over, and so they use their space to do that. There are members of ours that don't have that space in their homes, even though they wish they did. But the way that God's people learn to share with each other is an encouraging thing. So, anything else about that? Mike? Randy? Yeah, very good, very good. Anything else to say about that? All right, question number 8. How did Nehemiah's enemies try to get him to sin so that they could send a bad report? Anybody find that story in here? How did they try to get him to sin? All right, good. In chapter 6, around verse 10, they were intimidating him enough that they thought they would scare him and he would have to, like, flee and, like, hide himself in the temple. But listen to these words in chapter 6, verse 10. When I entered the house of Shemaiah, the son of Delaiah, son of Mehetabel, who was confined at home, he said, "Let us meet together in the house of God within the temple and let us close the door of the temple, for they are coming to kill you. And they are coming to kill you at night." But I said, "Should a man like me flee, and could one such as I go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in." Then I perceived that surely God had not sent him, but he uttered his prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He was hired for this reason, that I might become frightened and act accordingly and sin, so that they might have an evil report in order that they could reproach me. Remember, O my God, Tobiah and Sanballat according to these words, these works of theirs, and also Noadiah the prophetess and the rest of the people who were trying to frighten me. So these guys get to some of the actual Jews around Nehemiah, hire them to make false prophecies, and Nehemiah sees right through it. By the way, what's the reason he could see through it? How did he know it wasn't prophetic from God to go and hide in the temple? How did he know that? It's not really a trick question, by the way. Sam? Very good. I mean, it's that simple. It's not like he could tell. I don't know that he could tell by something on their face or their voice or whatever. He knew the law. The law said Nehemiah wasn't a priest. Nehemiah wasn't allowed in the temple. So somebody comes along and says, hey, God wants you to do this thing. There's an easy answer for this. I don't care if you're a prophet or not. If God said not to do it, that's not something I'm going to do. There's a great application in that when you have somebody stand in a pulpit or call themselves a prophet or a teacher and say, you know, God really wants this from us. God really wants this from us. But you know what Scripture says? The answer is no, that's not from God. So, great. Good point. Any other thoughts, sir? All right. Question number 9 kind of moves us into the second half of the book. When Ezra read the law, what did they realize they had neglected in chapter 8 there? Ezra gets up, reads the law to all the people. What did they realize they had neglected? Yeah, the Feast of Booths, chapter 8, verse 14. They found written in the law how the Lord had commanded through Moses that the sons of Israel should live in booths during the feast of the 7 months. So they proclaimed and circulated a proclamation in all their cities and in Jerusalem, saying, go out to the hills and bring olive branches. And then they went ahead and celebrated all of that. I want to point something out about chapter 8 that's not in your, well, it might be on the next page, I don't remember. But let's look at the beginning of chapter 8 just for a minute. All the people gathered as one man at the square which was in front of the water gate, and they asked Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had given to Israel. Then Ezra the priest brought the law before the assembly of men, women, and all that could listen with understanding on the first day of the 7th month. He read from it from before the square, which was in the front of the water gate, from early morning until midday, in the presence of men and women, those who could understand, and all the people were attentive to the book of the law. Ezra the scribe stood at a wooden podium which they had made for this purpose, and beside him stood all of these people. Go to verse 5. Ezra opened the book in the sight of all the people, for he was standing above the people, and then he opened it, and all the people stood up. Ezra blessed the Lord, the great God. The people answered, amen, amen, while lifting up their hands, and they bowed low and worshiped the Lord with their faces to the ground. Down there in verse 8, they read from the book, from the law of God, translating to give the sense so that they understood the reading. What do you find interesting about what we just read there?
Moses. And in verse 8, it's the law of God.
Okay, great point. The law of Moses and the law of God are synonymous.
Yep.
And that's a great text to show that. Good point. Anything else you find interesting there? So I'll tell you, I think this is a passage is like a preacher's dream. You know why? Because they wanted it. Like they're the ones. And notice the first half of Nehemiah is what one man who's a leader can do. The second half of Nehemiah is what can happen if there's a grassroots movement of people that say, we want to know what God says. So Ezra, come teach us, come read to us. We built you a podium. Start in the morning and read through the middle of the day. We'll stand up while you're preaching to pay attention. And they were all over it. This is a really cool time, I would say, in Israel's history, where at least for this moment, they're all in. Yeah, very good. So this actually answers question number 10. Why do the people pray in chapter 9? And as Sam said, they were confessing their sins, chapter 9, verse 3. They're praising God throughout the rest of it. But yeah, it's not just that they hear the preaching, it's that they respond to it. Their hearts are changed. There really is kind of this rededication that happens with the people. But what happens when Nehemiah leaves? So question number 11, what happened with Eliashib when Nehemiah went back to Babylon to be with the king? Obviously, the answer is things go downhill, but does anybody remember specifically what Eliashib did? Okay, he lets Tobiah move into the temple and like prepares a room for him there. Remember, Nehemiah wouldn't even go in when he was tempted? But this guy allows the enemies of God to come live in the temple. That's just so weird. Why was this wrong? Question number 12, obviously only the Levites were allowed, let alone, like, not the Gentiles. But when Nehemiah comes back, he has to deal with this. So the last question in your booklet, were the three other sins that Nehemiah had to correct at the end of the book? So he had to get Tobiah out of the temple, but what else did he have to fix? He had to reinstate a couple of things. Tithing, he had to reinstate, chapter 13, verse 11. The Sabbath, he had to reinstate, chapter 13, verse 17. And the people had been intermarrying with all the foreigners around them. This is at the end of chapter 13. And he has to deal with these mixed marriages and sort of get that right. That was similar to what happened in the book of Ezra, but slightly different ways that they were able to approach that, which we'll talk about more when we study this in greater detail. All right, Sam? Very good. So, yeah, among leadership, there are the kind of leaders that pull your hair out or pull their own hair out. Just take a glance at our elders, you know which is which by their hair, but like, we'll leave that there. All right, thanks. We'll do Esther next week.